William Manson versus General Motors Corp.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Bruce, and I represent the appellant in this matter, William Manson. By way of brief factual background, Your Honor, this matter is an appeal of a summary judgment, a ruling on a complaint which Mr. Manson filed for retaliation and for race discrimination and under the Americans with Disabilities Act. By way of brief factual background, Mr. Manson was a maintenance mechanic in the General Motors Electric Motor Division for 30 years, had a dispute with coworkers. As a result of that dispute, approached his union representative, and that dispute was handled informally. Those coworkers then continued to harass Mr. Manson. As a result, he complained again, and following a second complaint, his coworkers complained. As a result of their complaint, General Motors convened their internal committee, their formal committee, which is designed to resolve issues relating to violence in the workplace. Mr. Manson was not permitted to appear and give his side of the story. And as a result of that meeting, he was directed to visit the plant physician, which directive was broadcast over public two-way radio, the result of which is causing great stigma. He then filed an EEOC charge, and approximately 8 or 9 months later applied for a promotion to the position which directly exceeded his present position, and that promotion was denied. I would first like to address the retaliation count, because I think that at the time that I prepared my brief, I was unaware of a recent ruling by this court, particularly Stone v. Indianapolis Public Utilities, which clarified the standard for evaluating retaliation claims. And as I read that opinion, the standard is whether there is protected expression, whether an adverse action resulted, and whether if the plaintiff proceeds under a McDonnell-Douglas theory, whether the reasons offered for the denial of the adverse action, the reasons offered for that, are rebutted or invidious. If there's a question of fact, then that prevents the entry of summary judgment. In this particular case, General Motors responded that the reason that Mr. Manson was denied his promotion was because they were not promoting hourly employees at that time. In response to that argument, Mr. Manson submitted an affidavit which claimed that, in fact, General Motors was promoting hourly employees. That affidavit, therefore, rebutted the reason.
How do we factor, forgive me for interrupting, Mr. Bruce, but how do we factor in the fact that that was the next year, the time lag?
Well, Judge Rohner, I would say that you factor that in by evaluating the record in the light most favorable to Mr. Manson and finding that a one-year period is evidence of which goes to rebut the position of General Motors, and that the one-year time span goes through the sufficiency of that evidence, but not necessarily whether that, as a matter of law, determines the outcome.
And am I correct in that the only evidence as to that was entirely on his own affidavit?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor, his own affidavit. But we submit that affidavit met his burden of production of adducing evidence which rebutted the claim of General Motors that they were not promoting hourly employees. I'd also argue that that affidavit had self-verifying detail, was sufficiently detailed, and was not responded to by General Motors, and therefore was sufficient to create a question of fact. So with respect to that, Your Honor, I would ask that you reverse the trial court on the basis of Mr. Manson's retaliation claim. Mr. Manson also sought reversal on the grounds of race discrimination under a disparate treatment theory. The basis on which we ask the court to reverse is that General Motors failed to follow its legitimate routine procedures in evaluating violence in the workplace. In particular, their customary practice was to hear from both sides of a dispute. In this case, they did not hear from Mr. Manson. They heard from coworkers, and they heard from a union representative who represented both Mr. Manson and the coworkers, and therefore that coworker was not in a, that union representative was not in a position to advocate strongly Mr. Manson's position. He had, if you will, a conflict of interest. We certainly wouldn't let an attorney do what this union representative did. Secondly, the decision which the that committee reached, which was to refer Mr. Manson to the Klan position, was broadcast over a public two-way radio. And we also know that the custom and practice was to maintain confidentiality. The third aspect was that the General Motors treatment of Mr. Manson therefore became a symbolic form of discipline in the electromotive division. And we know that by the deposition of a coworker who said that now people say, well, you better watch out because they might pull a William Manson on you. So for that reason, Your Honor, we think there is a that the district court erred in entering summary judgment on Mr. Manson's disparate treatment claim.
And what were the adverse consequences he suffered as a result of the referral to the psychiatrist? What you were saying, what how his fellow employees felt about him?
Yes, Your Honor.
But there's not any other adverse consequence you can point to, is there?
Well, I would argue that the only evidence in the record that I can think of is, yes, the badge of shame which resulted from that action, but as the case law that I've cited indicates that such a badge of shame is sufficient to establish an adverse action, but also resulted in, well, there could also be a causal relationship between that referral and his subsequent denial of his promotion. So there's at least a possibly circumstantial basis that was also some harm that he required also.
Counsel, what were the qualifications, experience, and educational levels of the other people that were advanced as compared to Mr. Manson?
The education and...
experience and qualifications.
Okay. I believe they were comparable. And at a minimum, Mr. Manson was not, you're talking about the person who was in fact promoted for the position that Mr. Manson, I believe they both had college level educations, and I think that their qualifications were comparable. Certainly Mr. Manson's competence was not at issue at any point in this case. It was acknowledged by his coworkers and by his supervisors that he was a competent person, that he'd worked for the last 30 years in the workplace.
Was he ever attacked or threatened?
He was, yes, Your Honor, his car was vandalized. Coworkers so-called power walked in his vicinity. Gave him intimidating...
No, threatened, I said. Threatened, orally or physically, because somebody walks past, you know, or power walks. It's not a threat.
Well, not orally, and I think an argument can be made that there was a physical threat and there were attendant looks.
What were these physical threats?
I'm sorry, let me take that. There were no physical threats, but there were intimidating looks, and by virtue of the proximity of the power walking, which had never occurred in the 2 or 3 years prior, that these gentlemen had been power walking for 2 or 3 years inside the plant, and then following a dispute and following an explicit warning to Mr. Manson that he was being watched, several hours later or several within a half an hour, these gentlemen began power walking in his vicinity and began giving him intimidating looks. So I would say that there's no overt or explicit physical threat, but there's an implicit physical threat. And with that, Your Honor, I would ask that I reserve the Your Honor's
okay.
Reverse, and I would...
Sure.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, my name is David Vogel. I'm with the law firm of Lathrop & Gage in Kansas City, Missouri, and we represent General Motors Corporation in this action. you're all painstakingly familiar with the standard of review, which is obviously to look at the record as it was presented to the district court.
Speaking of the record, forgive me,
yes,
but where in the record will we find evidence that an employee told Mr. Casper that Mr. Manson had said he was a private investigator and was licensed to carry a gun?
You can
You cited the district court, but you didn't cite the record.
I apologize, Your Honor. I thought that was citing the record, and I apologize for not doing so. It's in two spots, in fact, Your Honor. It's in document number 25 on the court's record, which is the statement of fact that's presented by General Motors Corporation. It is specifically, it is fact paragraph 24. And then you can also see in document number 30, which was the plaintiff's response to those facts, that they admit that, that they make the express, unambiguous, unequivocal admission, which was actually, Your Honor, the first point I was going to make, where they come across and they say, yes, we admit that what happened in this case was there was this dispute between the employees, and there may even actually be some disputed facts about what exactly that dispute was. But what happened was Roger Casper, the safety director at that facility, had these employees come to him and say, we're concerned about those folks, and that's paragraphs 22 and 23 of those same documents, which the plaintiff then admits. And then one of them says to Mr. Casper, he said something about the fact that he carries a gun. And that triggers, that was a poor choice of words, but it triggers the safety department to say, wait a minute, the word gun has been used at this point, someone's made a reference to that, and we think this gentleman should go and talk to the medical director, and the medical director should take a look at this. And that was it. And that was all they did. The medical director then made a subsequent decision to refer the plaintiff out for some additional evaluation from some outside providers. But our point would be, with those express admissions that were before the district court, the plaintiff was agreeing that the basis for the referral was not his race. In fact, it was paragraph 27 of the fact, again admitted by the plaintiff, in which Mr. Casper said, I did not know Mr. Manson's race at the time I made this decision to ask him to see the plant doctor. And the plaintiff again admitted that. So the record that was before the district court was looking and saying, okay, he has these concerns that his referral is due to his race and it's some sort of a disparate treatment, which we looked at the issue of whether or not it was adverse action. We take the position that it's not adverse action, simply to ask someone to speak to a doctor inside the facility or outside the facility, because it does not have a material effect on the conditions of employment. But more important, the person who was responsible for that decision couldn't have considered race because he wasn't aware of the person's race, which was admitted by the plaintiff. And also, the person who made that decision was basing it on concerns that were raised. We were careful in preparing our statement of facts to the district court to say, I don't know if it's true or not whether Mr. Manson said he was licensed to carry a gun when he was speaking to these coworkers. The fact that was uncontroverted was that one of these coworkers said to the safety director that he made such a reference, and the plaintiff admitted that that's what the safety director heard. And I think that that's an important distinction that comes into the case with those admissions. I think the reason, one of the reasons that some of those facts were admitted below was the focus at the district court seemed to be whether the power-walking employees were somehow engaged in some sort of racial harassment toward the plaintiff, because it was acknowledged that these gentlemen did walk in his area and that the plaintiff felt that they were giving him what were referred to as intimidating looks and some glares and that sort of thing. But again, it was our position that there were admissions that that those employees were not motivated by race. The plaintiff acknowledged in his testimony that they were concerned about what they believed, perhaps wrongly, to be his causing the department to undergo a time study, which, as I understand it, is when someone comes in and sort of meticulously audits everyone's performance to make sure no one's messing around on the job. And they were under the impression that it was the plaintiff's fault that a time study was going to occur in the department. Again, nothing to do with his race, anger over work issues. I think it's important, very important, to address on the retaliation claim what happened in terms of presenting it. It was not simply the company's position that was argued before the district court that this had, that this was, Mr. Manson did not get the position because at that time the plant was not bringing hourly people into salary positions. There was a second issue that was argued that, if I recall correctly, was never really responded to, either at the district court or on appeal. the supervisor, who was going to be supervising the person to be in this position, sort of gathered up the names of the folks who had expressed interest, brought them to the personnel department, to a woman named Paula McGee, who was deposed in the case, and said, these are the people who have expressed interest. She went through the applications and said, whoa, we're not interviewing this guy because we're not interviewing hourly people at this time, and put it aside. She again unequivocally testified she did not know the plaintiff. She did not know that he had engaged in any sort of protected activity, formally or informally, by making a complaint about discrimination. So our argument in our brief and that was presented to the district court was, how can you retaliate if you do not know the person engaged in protected activity, which was our position. The fact that a supervisor who was aware that he had filed a charge with the person who sort of delivered the application really becomes wholly irrelevant, because it's uncontroverted that the person who made the decision was not that supervisor, and there's really nothing in the record that I can find that indicates that that supervisor had any influence over that personnel department representative's decision. With regard to the reason that was actually submitted, which was that they were not hiring hourly folks at that time, and this was really something I picked up on more so in preparing for the oral argument, but I agree, Judge, that one of the points that you're making is all his affidavit said was, well, sometime in 2000, I'm aware that these two salary folks became hourly folks. Not to dwell on it, but at that time, the affidavit that was presented to the district court originally was not notarized. It didn't say it was made under the penalties of perjury. It was just a signed statement. But regardless, the court looked at it and they said, well, one, there's really not any indication of personal knowledge here, how you came about having these facts. But then even assuming that's true, again, sometime in 2000, if you look at Ms. McGee's testimony, which was actually Exhibit F to GM's motion for summary judgment, the excerpts that are in there, the deposition testimony was, well, we weren't doing that because we were in the process of working on a new collective bargaining agreement. Now, I will acknowledge it's not expressly in the record when or if they reached a new collective bargaining agreement, but I think it's exactly right that if you say, well, at some unspecified time in the year 2000, and we don't know whether that's December of 2000, November 2000, a year later, a few months later, those circumstances may well have changed. I believe she also testified there were circumstances under which they might not do that. But that's where that argument went. I would just like to briefly touch on, even though it wasn't raised by the appellant in the oral argument, some important points on the plaintiff's ADA claim, which is essentially, simply put, that the decision to ask him to visit with the doctor was somehow regarding him as quote-unquote crazy, is I think how it was phrased in the district court papers. And I think it's very clear from cases both from this circuit and from other circuits that that's simply not an appropriate basis for a regarded as claim. Observing some behavior by someone that you think is different or aberrant and simply asking that person meet with a medical professional to discuss that does not rise to the level of regarding someone as substantially limited in a major life activity. And I think even if you look at cases applying those principles, such as the Cody case in the Eighth Circuit and the Stewart case in the Seventh Circuit, you can even put the condition that's a condition of remaining on the job, which was essentially what happened in this case. At one point they said to the plaintiff that if he did not agree to meet with the plant medical director that he would be suspended. You can make that a condition of working, and it still doesn't rise to the level of a substantial limitation. Again, I just want to emphasize that with what the plaintiff acknowledged was an admission that the plant had heard issues, true or not, that there were concerns about this gentleman, that there was an accusation that he made a reference to carrying a handgun and his right to carry a handgun. Those were admitted at the district court. That is what the folks who asked him to see the medical director based their decision on, and therefore we believe that there's no issue of race discrimination in this case and would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You've got 1 minute, sir.
Okay. First, I would say that the district court itself expressed some concern as to the believability of the charge that Mr. Manson had claimed that he was licensed to carry a gun. That's on page 13 of the opinion.
We can't hear you.
I would say that the district court itself expressed some possible disbelief of the assertion that coworkers had claimed that Mr. Manson said that he was licensed to carry a gun. The statement of facts and the admission thereto is a bit unfortunate, but I think it stands for the proposition that it was admission that the plaintiff, that the defendant was claiming that Mr. Manson made those statements. But if you look at the timing of when those that allegation was made, it was made after Mr. Manson, in his own discovery depositions, disclosed that information. The parties to the actual event, all the other parties, including the medical director, made no mention of the fact that Mr. Manson mentioned anything about a gun, which would be front and center for any consideration of violence in the workplace. Ms. McGee, the person who, and I will just
go ahead,
this last argument, who defendant claims made the decision not to promote Mr. Manson. I think that argument is not borne out by the record. There's no indication in the record that she was the relevant decision maker. And in fact, the record indicates that the relevant decision maker, one of Mr. Manson's supervisors, approached Ms. McGee. And so that supports the notion that he went to her, he sought her out for obtaining a pretext for denying him the promotion. So with that, Your Honor, I would ask this panel reverse the decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement and proceed.